Podcast. I'm your host, Ashley Rana Singha, and this week we are going to hear an interview I did with Chris Casper. He has some really exciting things going on. The most important thing that I want to make sure to highlight right now so that you stay tuned is that Chris is on a new adventure. He's working with a startup that is doing really cool things, and they are currently in the middle of a Kickstarter. So stay tuned. It's towards the end of the interview. You'll hear more information from Chris about it at that point. But I just wanted to make sure that I highlighted that because, well, I think it's so important that we support startups and offer anything we can when we have friends or people we care about who are doing exciting new things. So, Chris, we're wishing you all the best. I am going to get to the interview in just a second, but before we do, I want to talk a little bit because this is a new podcast and I want to make sure that I'm explaining to listeners, be it your first time or not, a little bit more about our podcast here and what we're doing. So Pivot Masters Podcast is a podcast where I, Ashley, interview people who have pivoted their careers, be it one time or many times, and they have an inspiring story to share. These stories that I've collected and interviews that I've done leading up to the release of this podcast have brought me a lot of inspiration and given me a lot of hope for even myself, my career options and what's available for me. And I hope that you're taking the same things away from this, or at the very least, just enjoying the story. I have a few places that you can learn about Pivot Masters Podcast. We are on Instagram, so it's Pivot Masters. That's literally it. So it's instagram.com/pivotmasters. We are on Patreon, patreon.com/pivotmasters. Boom. And you can subscribe on there. Subscribers to Pivot Masters Podcast on Patreon are able to get early access to the episodes, and there are parts of the episode I don't actually share on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you're listening. There are certain things that are exclusive to those who are subscribing on Patreon. So feel free to take a look at that and see if that's something you want to do. If you are listening on Spotify or Apple or Stitcher or wherever, please subscribe, follow, rate, share with your friends, tell. We are a brand new podcast and I want to make sure it gets out there. So join me. Let's get going. Today we're talking to Chris Casper, and he has just a really fascinating story to share. I'm going to start off by asking you to share a summary of your career so far.
Absolutely. So my career up to this point has been really interesting with some changes along the way. I started out working in the film industry. Right after school, I got an internship working at Disney's DreamQuest Images, where I was a production assistant. I used to get people lunch and sweep the floor and get, you know, copies of scripts. Every once in a while, I'd even hop on a plane with the film and fly to Canada to make sure that it got through customs. And okay. And as part of that, yeah, it's a really interesting way to start my career. One of the things that I had to do was I had to drive the film to the lab at the end of the day to get developed. This is back when movies were still shot on film. Yeah. And then I would go in the morning and pick up the film and bring it back for the assistant editors to cut together the dailies, which is how you string together all of the shots from the day before into a screening reel so that you can watch them and kind of evaluate how it went. It's a process to cut those together, so I asked them to teach me how to do it. And in doing so, I gained a new skill. That job turned into me becoming an assistant editor, and then into an editor working on films for many years. I ended up specializing in being a visual effects editor, so doing more complicated edits, title sequences for films. I worked on films such as Minority Report and Black Hawk Down and Moulin Rouge, Planet of the Apes.
Wow.
Yeah. And, you know, I did that for quite a long time. I think at this point I've done 26 movies, or I have credits on like somewhere around 26 to 30 movies. I'm not quite sure. And at a certain point, I decided that I wanted to take a break, and I found this company called ID Tech, where I was going to go spend the summer being a director of their film academy that they had on the East Coast. And so I did. This was, 10 years into my career. Went and spent the summer teaching at an academy and thought, oh, this is really fun. And they had, after that, asked me if I'd be interested in writing some of their curriculum for the film and photography courses. That's something that I did. And then I went back and became a director for one of their other programs. And then, actually, at a certain point, I signed on with them full time as a regional manager to run their summer camps. I felt like this is something that was so much fun and something that I enjoyed doing, that it was a good time for a career change. And I can get into more details about, specifically why I made that change, in a little bit. I know you asked for a summary here, and I'm going into more detail than you probably want.
No, this is great.
So I started working for ID Tech, and at the time I was living in Los Angeles, and they had me managing a lot of programs along the East Coast. And I decided, let's just make a move in life. I was ready for a change. And
because you were in LA.
I was in LA, yeah. And then I got on the plane and moved to New York City, literally with just suitcases, and kind of would fly home every once in a while and get more suitcases full of stuff and bring it out until I had all of my stuff in New York. I think that took about 2 years. And worked for this company, ID Tech, for almost 8 years. I started as regional manager. At one point, they decided they wanted to go international, and they put me in charge of their international expansion. So bringing the program to Dubai and Hong Kong and Singapore and all over the world. And during that point, I started transitioning from, being, solely in charge of managing programs and kind of managing the day-to-day operations to more business development. I picked up a lot of really useful business skills, finance skills in this time, and had set up 7 subsidiary corporations around the globe, which was an extreme change from what I was doing when I was cutting together, beautiful titles and images for movies. And then, of course, as we all know, COVID-19 happened, and many things changed. Exactly. Yeah. One of the consequences of that for me was that the division of ID Tech that I had built, the international division, overnight did not exist anymore. It's very hard to run in-person summer technology programs on university campuses when the world is shut down and no one's able to fly.
Right.
So I found myself in a position where, for the first time at 42 years old, for the first time since I was 15 years old, I was unemployed, which was a bit of an adjustment for me.
Sure.
But I took the time to, speak with, a variety of people about new positions. And the nice thing was, is that, between what I had been doing before with the film and creative work and the business development and management that I had been doing with ID Tech, I happened to find a role after about 6 months of, kind of patiently looking, a role that was the right fit for me. And I'm now the chief academic officer for a online film school and visual engineering school, which that might be a new term to a lot of people, but it's kind of taking the technical aspects of filmmaking, robotics, motion control, firing things off with pneumatics and a lot of like very precise control to get shots that, when you see like those amazing commercials where, liquid's flowing in that perfect slow motion and everything lands just right.
Yeah.
We're teaching people how to do that.
That's awesome. There's just so much to get into. So I'm going to actually rewind way, way, way back.
Sure.
So I first want to know what drew you to even applying or pursuing a job with Disney? What was there always this allure of working with Hollywood or film? Like, what was it for you?
I always enjoyed film and movies, and I when I was going to school, you know, my intention originally was to get a pre-law degree and go on to become a lawyer. I thought that would be a good profession. It wasn't necessarily what I wanted to do. I don't know. But it was, you know, when you're young, you kind of pick something. And
sure.
And while I was in school, I was also involved in the theater program at the time. It was at the Santa Barbara City College. They had a really good theater program, and I was part of that. And that was something that was new to me. In high school, it wasn't really, the cool thing to do for, you know, to get involved in theater, at least with the, you know, the guys that I hung out with. It wasn't something that, you know, we did. And then when I got to college, I'm like, oh, let's take an acting class because this seems, you know, like it'd be really fun. And it was, and I loved it. And I continued doing that all the way through school. And through that, kind of found, you know, that my, you know, my love of film and of production and being creative in that realm, it really kind of ignited in me. And I was fortunate enough to have this opportunity to have an entry-level job, you know, on a movie, which is in itself hard to get. You know, you don't just get to go, like, knock on the door and be like, hey, I'd like to do this. It took some, you know, calling some favors in from, you know, like, one of my mom's friends that I knew worked in the industry. And I have an uncle that I've only met like 3 times in my life that was somehow connected to this film. And he put in a good word for me. And after all these good words that I got to be the guy that was at the very bottom of the totem pole.
I would imagine that's pretty standard for that industry. Is that accurate or no?
It is. It is. And I was actually really lucky to become a production assistant. There are people that were at this company that were very hardworking people that were something called a runner, where they just drive things and pick things up, that were looking for an opportunity to become a production assistant. And so I got to jump a step, and I feel very fortunate that I was able to do that. I also appreciate all the hard work that the people that were trying to get that job were putting in, you know, when I kind of jumped the line a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. So when you were describing your early role and, you know, you're carrying the film to get developed, right? And they're the ones that kind of took you under their wing to learn this new skill. Do you feel like that was a pivotal moment for you, realizing like, oh, I can learn skills at jobs and taking advantage?
Well, I think the moment for me that I realized, you know, how, if I'm going to succeed in this business, how it has to happen, was it wasn't necessarily that anyone was saying like, hey, if you come do this, we'll teach you this skill. Right. It was me getting up an hour early, getting to the lab and getting back to the studio an hour and a half before anyone got there. I was the only one sitting there, you know, just kind of sitting by the film, and then taking the initiative to ask them like, hey, if you teach me how to log the key numbers on the side of the film, which is how you track it. It's like time code. And if you teach me how to, you know, cut the screening rolls, I'll have all of this done for you so you don't have to do it when you walk in. So it was finding a way to make their life easier, and in exchange for that, learning a skill.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. It just speaks a lot to your drive. I mean, obviously you were young in your career at that point, but it's clearly been something that you've carried on throughout your career. Let's move forward a little bit. I want to hear what was happening in your career in Hollywood that made you want a break. Why did you need that break?
It's a really good question. I needed the break. There was a couple things happening at that point. The industry in itself was starting to go through a transition where jobs were becoming a little bit different. A lot of work started getting farmed out overseas, and companies were, in general, having a harder time staying afloat. And so it was changing the dynamic of what it was like to work in a visual effects company. A great example of this is you look at Rhythm and Hue Studio, who won the Oscar for Life of Pi, but had to close their doors before they won the award. So at the top of their game, and there was still like a lot of pressures. But aside from that, for me, I had always, when I was younger, done volunteer work with the YMCA doing summer camps. Just like traditional outdoor, you know, bow and arrow canoeing kind of summer camps.
Right, right.
And so, you know, it was something that I, you know, kind of longed to be part of a little bit more. It always brought me joy in my life. And with the way that things were, you know, kind of shaking out with the whole film visual effects industry in general at that point. And it's an amazing industry to be in. It also is long hours and a lot of very hard work. You're often putting in 12, 16-hour days. And for a long time, I didn't mind that. I thought that was something great. When I got into my early 30s, I started to question if that's something I wanted to maintain doing for the long run.
Right.
And so, you know, that was kind of where my head was at when I decided to just temporarily go off and do a summer camp.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I want to hear a little bit about that transition that you had going from working in Hollywood, you're working these really wild hours, and now you're working at a summer camp. Tell me a little bit about some of the things that you had to learn or skills that you didn't realize you would need in that position that you developed as you started working there.
So when I was working in Hollywood, it's very fast paced. People are very direct. And sure. Yeah, the things like the way that you communicate is very different and can be sometimes a little bit harsh compared to how you have to, you know, approach not working with the kids necessarily. It's always easy to tell, you know, when you should be, you know, polite. It's always easy to tell that you should be polite around kids and the way that you should speak with them. But maybe, you know, it took a little bit of adjustment right off the bat with the staff. You know, you have these 20, 21-year-old college kids that are working for you teaching classes. And when I first came into it as a program director, I had been working with assistant editors and people that were working for me in the Hollywood side who were very motivated and hardworking. And this was something that they, you know, this is an opportunity to do something really exciting. And they're willing to put in the 140% effort. And then I got to working with people that this is a summer job for them. This may not be their top priority. And there are different ways that you have to motivate them. So that was the biggest adjustment for me right off the bat was, you know, learning how to work with someone that just, you know, this is not a high priority job for them.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And I'd imagine even at a certain level, having worked the same job as you, there's the customer service element, right, of working with parents who have maybe a lot of emotions because it's their child. And that direct line of communication that you had in Hollywood probably won't always work with a parent.
Well, it's funny. There actually is more of a correlation because on the Hollywood side, you're working with a lot of creatives and filmmakers and people that are also very passionate about this film, which they would call their child. This is their baby that they're trying to nurture into the world. So, you know, that same level of, you know, taking what they have to say is, you know, like the most important thing in the world. Like to the parents, their child is the most important thing in the world. And to the, you know, to the cinematographer, that, you know, this footage and this shot is the most important thing. And so there's actually a clearer line between dealing with the parents and dealing with the creatives in film than you would think.
Really? Now that you describe it in that way, right, it makes complete sense. I've worked with fine artists, not in Hollywood, but painters and gallery artists, and similar feelings of this is my baby. the pride and the passion that they have for that is quite clear. Yeah, that is a great point. I am curious to learn a little bit more about your Hollywood experience, if you're comfortable with us diving a little bit more into it.
Sure. What would you like to know?
I want to know, what are some of the memories that you have from that time? What are some things that stand out as poignant moments in your life that you'll just never forget?
Oh, I mean, there's so many. From very early on, I was so young and kind of got thrust into, you know, these opportunities to be a visual effects editor. at a company called Asylum Visual Effects, which is an incredible company run by one of the most creative people that I've ever had the opportunity to know. His name is Nathan McGinnis. And, you know, through that, you know, there were so many, you know, like every day there was something new coming in and a new director or someone that I'd looked up to and admired. And I was working on films with Steven Spielberg. You know, wow. In my mind, I'm like, wow, I'm 23 years old and I'm working on Minority Report. This is amazing. Yeah. I would say some of the, you know, the really cool kind of standout things that, you know, as a post-production person, you're not often on set. You're not kind of right in the middle of the Hollywood, you know, glamour kind of stuff. You're working in an office. But, you know, occasionally I would get to go on set for one reason or another. And, you know, and see just, you know, how amazing it is. I got to go down to Mexico for Master and Commander Far Side of the World and you know, and sit, you know, 10 feet away from, you know, Russell Crowe and Paul Bettany watching them, you know, go through scenes and act out, you know, playing, you know, admirals in the British Navy. And being that close to it is really cool. For me, I think some of the really special things where I started working with a man named Bob Dawson, who is a legendary title designer. And through that, he created the opening title sequences for many, many films that you've seen. And one of the directors that he worked with was someone that I admire so, so much, Tim Burton.
Wow. Yeah.
So I got to work on the you know, the first title sequence that I got to be the editor for was Planet of the Apes, the Tim Burton one. And just being part of that process of, you know, we didn't just like slap titles on something. We built out storyboards and put my assistant editor in like the ape suit and kind of shot like, this is what it's going to look like when we do all of this. And then he delivered it to Tim and he said, let's do it. And, you know, there's like surreal moments where, you know, we're cutting everything together. And even though I'm the editor, I'm still the young guy. So at the end of the day, they're like, okay, we need to get this to the composer to you know, have him start putting music on it. And they're like, well, we don't really have anyone to drive it. Chris, can you hop in your truck and drive this down to Danny Elfman's house? I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like another really kind of surreal and like memorable moment for me was when we were working on Moulin Rouge. There's mm-hmm. a point where the there's this scene where the Elton John song Your Song is playing, and Ewan McGregor picks up Nicole Kidman and spins her above the clouds of Paris. Mm-hmm. It wasn't quite shot right, so they needed stand-ins to take the place of Ewan McGregor and Nicole Kidman. And our reception was this like tall, slender, redheaded girl named Susie, and I am about the same size as Ewan McGregor, so they put me in the tux and shot me on a green screen picking up, you know, and doing the beginning of that spin. And if you go watch that movie and you like freeze on the beginning, like where it's the, you know, the big pull out above the clouds, it's me.
That's you.
It's me.
I know what I'm doing this weekend. That's so cool. That's awesome.
Yeah, working in visual effects, there's a lot of opportunities to kind of sneak yourself into things. I was one of the Somali soldiers running around on the roof in night vision, of course, because I don't look like a Somali soldier in Black Hawk Down. Yeah. I'm one of the people on the subway train in the beginning of Janet Jackson's All For You music video. You can kind of like, yeah, dot yourself in different places. It's a lot of fun.
Oh my gosh. Chris, I'm officially going to be like paying attention now to see if I can find you in in different films. This is so cool. I'm curious, from that experience in Hollywood, would you say that you've built any lasting relationships, or is that difficult to do in that industry?
No, I absolutely have lasting relationships. People that I worked with, some of them are still some of my best friends. People that I worked with back in those days are people that I still regularly talk to. And they're not just in LA. Many of us have kind of spread out across the world. I have visited friends that I've worked with on films in Dusseldorf, Germany. Every time I stop into London, I have a couple people that I regularly say hi to. It's an amazing thing to be part of this global community of filmmakers that maybe we've moved on. Like my friend in London is now writing children's novels, and he used to also be a graphic designer or a film designer with me. But whatever we've moved on to, we've stayed in contact, and it's nice to catch up and reminisce about what we've been doing.
I would imagine it's almost like people who have experience of returning to the same summer camp every year, right? You kind of have this bond. You're working all the hours of the day and have a unique experience that most of us can't relate to.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So moving forward, you start working for this camp and you get brought on full time to work with them. Tell me a little bit about your experience there. What were some of the things that you were doing? What were you learning? How did it go for you?
Sure. Well, it's interesting, you know, just to give anyone who's listening context, you and I started doing this at the exact same time together.
Yes, we were interviewed together.
We were.
Partially. Part of our interview was in the same room.
It was. And we were both selected, which is great. But we, for me, there was a lot to learn. I think, you know, especially at the time when we came into the company, it was kind of trial by fire. It was like, all right, you're a regional manager, like, go do it. And I think as the company, you know, grew, there's a lot more structure and kind of walking people through that first 2 years. But for us, it was like, okay, you know, you've gone through training and now you're going to hop on a plane, you're going to go meet a university liaison, and you're going to negotiate with them. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the first things that I was like, wait, I don't, I've never done this before. What am I doing? Like, yeah, you're going to get in there and you're going to negotiate the right of our classroom and our meal packages, and you're going to make sure that they have all the things that we need.
Yeah.
And then you're going to hop on the plane and leave there and go talk to another university and do the same thing, except for it's going to be a completely different experience because, like, everyone plays by their own basic rules per university. So it's not the thing for me which I very quickly picked up on, and I'm sure you did too, was it was all about relationship building and like taking the time to get to know someone. You know, I had a liaison that I learned really loved talking about wine. Thankfully, my mom has a degree in wine from UCLA and also likes talking about wine. So I've picked up some from osmosis, and I learned that, okay, you know, I want to start talking about, you know, how much is it going to cost for a double classroom. But I realized that if I spend 15 minutes talking about Cabernet Sauvignon with this person, I'm probably going to get a better rate on that classroom.
Right.
Yeah. These were all new things. You know, before that, I was, you know, my job was, you know, sitting in a dark room and making very pretty pictures and occasionally, you know, working with the people above me to refine those images and get them to a place that they were happy with. And now I was doing business. And, you know, that wasn't something that I focused on in school. It wasn't something that I had been doing as a film professional. And it was, but it was something that I had to quickly pick up and adjust to. Otherwise I would have sunk in that business.
I just want to ask though, you mentioned school there, but you did study pre-law, correct?
That's not really business.
No, yeah. But were you more comfortable reading the contracts than I feel like you might have been more comfortable reading the jargon of the contract than say myself, who has no law background.
That is true. That was somewhere that I was able to look through them. I felt comfortable with that. And it was something that benefited me all the way through the end of my time, you know, with that company was, you know, as I started trying to assess and build out new contracts in new countries.
Yeah.
And working with the in-house counsel that we had, you know, having that previous experience from school was really beneficial.
Yeah, what a unique way that it kind of showed up for you in your life, that degree and that background.
I know. And and you know, maybe the acting classes too.
For real. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure there were moments in your contract negotiations like I had where you're like, yes, I love this. And let's talk more about your side hobbies and make you comfortable.
Of course I want to go have barbecue with you after having it with the last three people.
Naturally.
I do like barbecue. Yeah.
You should have managed Texas then, because I was swimming in barbecue and I'm a vegetarian. So.
Yeah, my first couple of years, it was North Carolina and Atlanta where I got the good barbecue.
Yeah. You and I both managed North Carolina
at the
that
same
first
time,
year.
Just different programs.
Exactly. Yeah. All right. So let's talk a little bit about the development of this international program, if you're comfortable with that.
Sure.
I'd love to hear what that experience was like for you, what you enjoyed about it, what was difficult. Tell me more.
Okay. Starting at the international programs for ID Tech was absolutely amazing. To give context, it wasn't something where they randomly came to me and just said, "Hey, Chris, do you want to fly to Dubai tomorrow?" I had expressed interest in it for many years and let them know that if this is something that ever comes up, I want to be considered as the person that will do it, which is kind of what I've done with my entire career, is letting people know exactly what I would like to be doing next and asking them what I need to do to get there. And, you know, and even to the point where I, you know, when I was in Los Angeles visiting my mom, just made a point to stop by the chief operating officer of ID Tech's house and have lunch with her and kind of reiterate, you know, that this is something that I really want to do. And that turned into her giving me a call and saying, "Hey, do I think this is going to happen? We're going to go to Dubai. Are you ready? It's next week." And I'm like, "Yeah." And, you know, we hopped on a plane and we went out there and we had meetings. And
did you go to the mall?
Which mall? There's like so many malls.
Like that giant one that you can get to from the airport. There's like the tram that goes in.
I don't think so.
Okay, so I just wanted to pause for a quick second and share this little bit of information I have with you. Chris is far more traveled than I am, but I have been to Dubai on a quick layover. By quick, I mean, I want to say it was 12 hours or 24 hours. It was a, you know, relatively short period of time. There is a mall. If you ever get stuck at the Dubai airport, the Dubai Mall is available. It's kind of stunning. It's bright and shiny and super clean and really pretty. I didn't buy anything. I did eat at a restaurant. My husband and I just kind of relaxed and it was quiet and peaceful. The Dubai Mall is about a 30-minute ride on, let's see, on their metro from the airport. So if you're at the airport and you hop on the metro, you can head on over to the Dubai Mall. It's kind of obvious once you're there that you're at the mall. Like, there's going to be a mass exodus from the, you know, the train. So anyways, the metro, sorry. So yeah, that's my little fun tidbit for travel. Enjoy.
Yeah, shortly after that meeting, we flew back, and then some other people from ID Tech, that Pete, who's the CEO, and Joy, the chief operating officer, flew out to Hong Kong and had a meeting. And I didn't go on that one because there was something that I was still running camps in the United States. So I needed to continue to do that job. And that meeting went well. And they said, "Okay, now you fly out there on your own and you're going to meet someone and he's going to walk you through the University of Hong Kong." And that was an absolutely incredible experience. I remember the first time I stepped foot in Hong Kong. It's an amazing city. It's maybe one of my favorite places, probably my second favorite place after New York. And then next thing you know, I'm running these, you know, these two summer camps. And there's a lot of challenges that come along with running programs on the other side of the planet. One is hiring people on the other side of the planet when you have a 12-hour time difference. And you know, I realized very quickly that what I was signing on for was a 24-hour work schedule, which was a huge thing to adapt to. You have to kind of, you know, find and make time, you know, for yourself in the middle of the day so that you can have that 10 p.m. until midnight, you know, interview or meeting. And this is something that also, you don't figure out how to do overnight. You refine the process until you get to a place where, you know, doing international business is I think anyone that does it will tell you the same thing, that it's, you know, it's not a 9-to-5, and it's a whole different way to approach your life in general, because you have to, the other things that you want to do, you know, going out to dinner with your partner or, you know, going to the gym, like all of these things kind of have to be rearranged based off of this global time schedule. But the experience of, you know, starting up the programs and dealing with different cultures was, I think, really where I found myself to be most happy with my time at ID Tech. I loved it. I loved every aspect of it. And, you know, flying into Singapore and learning about their culture and the way that people communicate and how it's so different than the way that we communicate in New York City. And, yeah, kind of going for, you know, tram rides through Taiwan and, you know, getting shown coffee fields and tea, and not coffee, just tea. you know, ending up in Korea and Japan, and yeah, you know, I'm naming off a lot of Asian places, but also Switzerland and the UK. And I felt myself to be really at home traveling. And so this was something that it was probably, you know, for this section of my career where I was working in the summer camp business, that was the peak of it for me. Being able to be a global citizen. And, you know, there was one point where I was leaving Switzerland and just kind of realized that if I did a stopover somewhere, it would make the flight a lot cheaper to get home. And I'm like, oh, well, my old roommate from New York lives in Paris. I'll just stop over there for 2 days and have dinner with him. And it was a really kind of like unreal moment for me where I'm like, this is something that I do now. I just stop in Paris to have dinner.
It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, it really was. And I do, you know, for the last 6 months, I've been not only, you know, kind of grounded in New York, but we sit at home the majority of the time because we're being responsible and safe. And, you know, we want to make sure that we are healthy and doing our part to, you know, not make the pandemic any worse. But it's been a massive adjustment for me. I used to leave the house every other month for 2 to 3 weeks and just be somewhere else around the planet.
Yeah. Yeah. And we should be clear, because we are recording this and this will air at a later date. So today is October 30th of 2020. Like, who knows? Tomorrow there could be this amazing vaccine and we're all just, you know, flying around the world again. And that would be amazing. But we can't predict the future, because maybe you've been traveling between now and then because it's safe or something. Since you have been grounded now for 6 months, if you could travel anywhere, where would you go?
Oh, that's a really good question. I would like to go back to Hong Kong. I spent, you know, totaling all the time and the trips that I went out there over the last 3 years. I probably spent about 3 months out of the year for the last 3 years in Hong Kong. And wow. Network of friends and people that, you know, it was my second home and my second community. And it very abruptly changed. Things in Hong Kong, aside from the pandemic, have very abruptly changed. And it's been a hard go for them. And I would like to just see my friends. At this point, the world becomes a very small place when you travel all around it. And I love seeing new places and, you know, new cultures. But really, for me, I just want to see my friends.
Yeah. Yeah. What is happening in Hong Kong right now? Are you hearing from friends, like, the status of things? What's going on?
Well, it's a long, complicated topic that the Hong Kong government and the structure of the Hong Kong government is changing the way that it's managed. I don't really want to get into a lot of specifics on this, because I don't have all the information and I don't want to misinform. But I just know that the relationship between mainland China and Hong Kong is ever changing and adapting, and for some people it's not going the way that they want it, and for others it is.
Sure. Yeah, I respect that. All right. So you have this job, you're traveling internationally, you're having dinner in Paris when you can. Tell me a little bit about what's happening in your life outside from work. Is work your life, or do you have other things kind of going on?
It's a really good question. And for a large portion of my time starting up this international business, work was my life. Now I have my friends and I have my community here in Brooklyn. It can be a bit of a challenge to maintain relationships when you are leaving every other month for multiple weeks at a time.
Yeah.
And I did a decent job, but it wasn't ever anything. Yeah, it definitely puts a strain on things. About a year and a half ago, I met someone that I really, really connected with, and she, was someone that also would travel, not year round like I did, but was used to going off and traveling for the summer because she's a television producer and they go on hiatus for the summer. And we started dating and things, went really well and are going really well.
Yay.
and then after, I think about like 8 or 9 months, we had made plans to, because she was going to have the summer off, we were going to travel the world. And we were going to start by going to the Glastonbury Music Festival before I kind of went and set up the camps in London. And then at this point, I had regional managers that were on my team that were doing the managing of the camps. And my role was really focused on going to new countries and setting up new business development. So I was less involved with, the like going and checking on the kids, but I was going to be doing that. And we were going to go to, a lot of new exciting countries that we were planning on opening up camps in, travel all the way around the world. She also surfs, so we were planning on maybe doing a little stop in Bali for, to catch a wave.
Nice. Yeah.
And then she was a competitive swimmer in college, so we were going to end the trip at the Tokyo Olympics and going to watch some of the swimming competition, and then we were going to fly home and we were going to move in together. And I know, doesn't that sound amazing?
It sounds amazing.
I know.
2020.
But looking at everything has a silver lining, and I think that's the nice part about the story that I'm going to tell today is, throughout all of the difficulties that 2020 has given us, some good things came too.
Yeah.
And so March happens, and in February I had plane tickets to go to Korea. I had meetings in Korea and Hong Kong, and those got canceled because the pandemic was starting to take place in Asia.
Yeah.
And it's a good thing that I did cancel them, because I would have got stuck in the country and not been able to move. It was just right at that time. And then, a few weeks later in March, everything gets shut down, including my job. And all of this summer travel was kind of been around this long extended business trip that we had planned. So we canceled the trip, and I started looking for a new job. But at the same time, because New York City was hit so hard, and it was, we didn't want to be outside. And her apartment was right next to the NYU Medical Center, and had a lot of medical personnel that lived in it because it was a block away from the hospital.
Sure.
She was on the 14th floor of a giant tower, and we just didn't feel that it was the right place for either of us to be. So she, you know, grabbed bags. We filled up as much stuff as we could, and she came over to my place and, you know, kind of unofficially started living together at that point. And then in June, she was able to get out of her lease early, and we officially packed up all of her stuff, and she moved in, and we have been here. You know, kind of our relationship has gone through this amazing thing where it might have, you know, gone a little bit slower if we were still in our own places and like doing different things. Maybe not, because, you know, we're at an age where, you know, we're either going to do this or we're not. But the good thing is we, you know, we've lived together now for about 7 months since all of this started. And, you know, we still love each other very much, and it's going really well. So, you know, in the middle of all of the, you know, the things that I can, you know, complain about 2020, there's something really amazing that happened for me.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, you definitely went into maybe the deep end of cohabitating.
Yeah. 100%.
Because there's no like, oh, I'm leaving for work every day, and we had, you know, we're disagreeing about where the ketchup goes in the refrigerator or whatever goofy, silly thing, right? That comes with adjusting to living with someone.
I am always there, and if she can handle me this much, like, imagine how easily she'll be able to handle me when, you know, I go to work. It's gonna be great.
I'm really happy for you. This is great news. Congratulations. Yeah. And I think you're right. I think for everyone, 2020 has presented a number of different hardships or having to face different things. But I think most people are able to recognize the things that are at the core, what they're grateful for, right? And what we need to hold on to and cherish. And I'm really glad to hear that your relationship is one of those things.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's definitely the highlight of the year for me.
Good for you, Chris. All right, so 2020 happens. You've got some good things happening in 2020. You did get laid off, though. And you're looking for a job. So I think it was LinkedIn, maybe we chatted and you were saying you were, you know, interviewing for a variety of different jobs, but how did you land with what you're currently doing?
So yeah, I was laid off. The entire division of ID Tech that I was, you know, running ended. And I started going back on the job hunt, and it was a really interesting process for me. I'd been on the other side for so long, hiring people. Mm. And I was very fortunate that, you know, I left on very good terms, and a lot of the people that I had been working with, you know, from the CEO down, were there to support me in finding my next job and wrote me really great letters of recommendation and kind of endorsements. But then it was a process of, you know, getting myself back out there and applying to jobs on LinkedIn and doing it at a time when so much of the workforce had been laid off and companies can all of a sudden get very picky because I had a LinkedIn premium account and I could see like, oh, I applied for this job, which I feel like I'm a perfect fit for. I'm one of 976 applicants.
Yeah.
And I had to learn about application tracking systems and the way that they sort things before I ever get in front of a human person. Being. And
yeah,
because at the beginning I was very confused. I was like, I don't understand. Like, I feel like my skill set is so great for this job. Why didn't anyone reach out to me? And it was a bit disheartening, and yeah, it can be extremely challenging. And something that I, you know, will tell anyone that is, you know, going through that process of trying to find, you know, a new role or a new position or, you know, making a change in their career is don't take it personally when you're not getting the responses that you think you should. It's not you. it's just that there are so many people, and you may not even be getting your information put in front of a live human that's, you know, making an assessment. You just have to be persistent and keep your head up.
Yeah.
And so I think it took like 6 weeks before I got my first interview. And I put out, you know, at this point, maybe 100 applications to, and not just throwing like things against the wall to see what would stick. I was a director of operations. I was applying for director of operations roles.
Right.
I very quickly learned that if you're a director of operations, the computer wants you to have an MBA, which is something that I did not. So I think a lot of times that would be like, oh, well, you know, or you know, even if that was the case, there were 60 people that did that were also in that pile of applications. You know, there's a million different ways that you can get, you know, kind of hung up in this process. I got my first interview and I remember going into it thinking like, I am going to be so, so good at this interview. Because for the last 7 years, I interviewed, I probably conducted 200 to 300 interviews on my end as the interviewer. And I'm like, I know this process so well. Like I know what everyone's thinking when the hiring manager asks this question and that question. Mm-hmm. And I got into that first interview and I was terrible. I rambled. I didn't like answer the questions right away. And like in my mind, I knew what I was supposed to be saying. And but I had no practice being on the the interviewee end. And so that was a wake up call. Then I did a couple more and I went through some longer, like kind of protracted experiences where they had me like filling out business plans and like, you know, kind of, you know, put a lot of work into a lot of these. And yeah, and they don't always give you feedback on why you weren't the person selected. But you keep going and you keep trying. And, you know, it's important, I think, to stay confident in yourself and your skills. And at the same time, I was also spending my free time, which I had more of, learning new skills. Like I became certified in Google Analytics and, you know, learning more about SEO and marketing things. Because as you apply for a lot of different jobs and you're on this hunt, at least for me, what I found is I started realizing a little bit more about what I wanted to do by the jobs that I gravitated towards a little bit more. And I realized that the thing that I really liked in my last job, especially with the international portion, was I loved the marketing. I loved, you know, kind of getting out there and promoting our programs and, you know, doing the, like, it's marketing kind of business development hand in hand. It's like, okay, I've secured this relationship and now I have to actually, like, you know, make this into a business and sell it. Yeah. And so through the process of applying and, you know, kind of like sifting through jobs, I naturally found myself thinking like, oh, this is something that I really enjoy. And so I started taking classes in that area and applying for marketing jobs. Now, of course, you know, I'm applying for like director of marketing at a company and nothing on my resume says that, you know, I have these skills, even though I did. It was kind of the downside of my last job is you get to do everything, like a little bit of everything, but like your title doesn't necessarily say that. And when you're going to a new job, people often just want to see, like, we want someone that says director of marketing on their resume to become our new director of marketing.
Right.
Anyways, you know, this process went on for a long time. And then I saw a job that, you know, I looked at it and went, wow, this seems perfect. And it was someone that was starting up an online school that taught filmmaking principles, something called visual engineering, which is the combination of tech with cinematography and filmmaking. And I looked at this and I said, oh, well, okay. I have many years of experience in film and about the same amount of years experience working in education and tech education at that. And this, you know, this, they were looking for a chief academic officer. And I'm like, well, that seems, you know, like an awesome title and, you know, maybe a little bit above my current, you know, title of what I had before, but a lot of the skills that I have are like very like kind of hyper-focused on what they're trying to do. And so I applied and, you know, did all the things that, you know, I think you should do. You know, I applied, I followed up with a really nice follow-up email where I included a letter of recommendation from the CEO of my old company. Because it was an education job, the vice president of Education and Innovation wrote me a letter of recommendation that was very specific to, you know, kind of what this job would entail. And I included that as well. I got an interview and, you know, spoke with the CEO, and then he followed up by saying, you know, he kind of was looking for a co-founder or partner, and, you know, and he has like a long list of questions of what it is that, you know, all the things he wants to know about someone he would go into business with. And it was an extensive, it was like 32 questions. And I got him and I asked him, you know, can I have a week to go through this? And he says, yeah. And I sent him back an extremely long, detailed document.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like there were no short answers. It was like paragraphs. Yes. You know, like even like questions. He's like, what is your, you know, how do you feel design fits into business? What's the importance of design? I wrote him like a textbook. But, you know, I wanted to show him that I was really passionate and that this was the job that I was ready to take on and that I was the right person for it and the right person to be his partner. And I was really thankful that then, you know, that led to another meeting and then an in-person meeting. And of course, the way that the world works, you know, after, you know, 6 months of, you know, like really kind of no real good jobs fitting, right when this is coming towards its end, another post-production company that I hadn't worked directly for, but I'd worked with, a very big one, he has offices in LA and New York, reached out about a role. I'm not gonna say what it was, but it was a really good job within their company. And so now all of a sudden I'm like, oh great, you know, I had no options for so long and now I have two and I have to pick and I don't know. And then, you know, and it was, do I work with the startup, or you know, I have a lot of potential to grow this company and to do some really amazing things and work with someone at this point, Steve, who's now my partner with the Garage Learning. I'd gotten to know him and I really like him. I think he's a person that I trust and I, you know, I want to do business with. Or do I want to jump back into that, you know, kind of Hollywood world that at some point I made the decision to leave because, you know, it wasn't fulfilling me in the way that I wanted it to. Mm-hmm. One of them is more stable and one of them is a startup. I made the choice to go with the startup and to ultimately work on something, surround myself with people that I wanted to be around. Not to say that the other company are people that I wouldn't want to be around, but I don't know who I'd be working with that one. Whereas I know that, you know, Steve, and up to this point, we've been working together for 2 months, and you know, and I stand by this decision that I think I've made the right choice and I've surrounded myself with the right people, and this is the job that's going to make me happy.
Yeah. Well, first off, what's the name of the company?
The name of the company is called The Garage Learning.
The Garage Learning. Do you want listeners to be able to find you, Chris?
Absolutely. You can find us. We have a Kickstarter going right now, and we would love for you to come and support us on the Kickstarter. If you go to Kickstarter and search The Garage Learning, you can find us that way. Or if you just type in thegaragelearning.com, it'll take you to our landing page, which has a link right back into the Kickstarter. Both great ways to find us. And what we're doing is we're offering a variety of subscription levels and courses. So we have our pro level, which is for like working professionals and people in the film industry in commercial production, you know, they can learn, you know, Steve's tricks with high-end cameras and, you know, all the best equipment. We have everything down to a beginner level where you're shooting with a smartphone and maybe you just want to learn how to like make better videos. A lot of what they do is food styling. If you're someone who wants to upload videos to TikTok or to Instagram and kind of, you know, be like a food critic or anything like that, we're giving you all of the tools for, you know, the wide variety of skill sets. And then if you're really into the kind of the techie side of things, we have these awesome kits where you can like get like pneumatic triggered catapults and turntables and trigger boxes and, you know, work with Arduinos and all sorts of fun science stuff as well.
That sounds like a ton of fun. Okay, so The Garage Learning is this startup that you are working with. I'm curious to know, like, do you feel like you're home? Like, is this where you see your career for the foreseeable future?
It is. It's, you know, it combines all the things that I like. filmmaking, creativity, art, science, and tech, you know, with a platform where we get to design the learning management system, we get to design the way that students ingest this information, and we also are creating a global community by doing it. It's not just going to be like watching a video and going off and doing something on your own. We're going to have places for you to interact with people all around the world, for students to interact with people all around the world. And for me, it's a combination of all of the things I've been doing up to this point, and it feels very natural and something that I will probably be doing for a very long time.
I'm very excited for you. Chris, tell us anything you want us to make sure we know about in regards to the Garage Learning.
So the Garage Learning is the first school that's going to teach a concept we call visual engineering. And it's where art and science are combined. It's an online film school. We're going to have people that are the best in their business coming in and doing master classes. So if you're going to be learning about, let's say, visual effects, we're going to be bringing in, you know, some of the visual effects people that we know that are currently working in visual effects and doing amazing things. The same thing, you know, with audio recording, with, you know, cinematography. Steve's going to be teaching some of those classes. He's an amazing photographer. And it's a great place to either explore your creative skills or take them to the next level. And we're also going to have a lot of amazing classes for kids that would be in our beginner level, places where they can, you know, get the creative juices flowing and do it in a way where they're integrating art and science and learning that the two aren't different, which I think is something that when I was a kid, I didn't know. I thought you're either an artist or you're like a mathematician or a scientist. And that's not true. You can be both at the same time and have an amazing career.
You're speaking to my heart right now on so many levels, Chris. Yes, art and science are a lot more related than I think, you know, people realize. How exciting. All right, Chris. So we have ways, and we're going to include in the description of today's podcast episode how to get in touch with you and your website for the Garage Learning. Is there anything that you want to leave us with in regards to what the future holds for the Garage Learning that you're excited about?
Yeah, absolutely. With the Garage Learning, we're just getting started. So, you know, we're doing our Kickstarter. We're building out the studio. We have our first set of classes. But we plan on adding two classes every month, like in perpetuity. And right now we're covering all the amazing filmmaking knowledge that we have and the engineering and science stuff. So when we launch the Garage Learning in June, we will have 10 classes for each skill level. So a total of 30 classes that we're going to have. But after that point, the plan is to release two classes every month. And we're going to release those every month, you know, for the rest of time. We're going to be adding a lot of cool stuff in there, like stop motion animation and also the business side of things, you know, like how to market yourself as a creative entrepreneur, how to put your best work forward, how to, you know, not just be someone who makes creative things, but how to make a living out of it. And I think that's the thing that, you know, is one of our unique points, is that we're teaching you how to, you know, like do cool stuff and then how to do cool stuff for a living.
Yeah. I love to hear it. Thank you so much, Chris, for your time. I know that you're very busy with everything, getting a startup going and having a Kickstarter, all of those things. So I just really appreciate you carving out time in your day.
Yeah, absolutely. It's good to talk to you.
It's good to talk with you. Yeah, it's been years since I've spoken with you. And it's just an awesome feeling to catch up with you in a moment where it feels like you're kind of like on this high. It's fun to watch. All right, guys, that was amazing. Chris is doing really awesome things. We are wishing him and the Garage Learning team all the best with their Kickstarter and everything they have coming up. We are cheering you on, and we will keep you up to date. If there are any exciting news that, you know, Chris shares with us, we will share with listeners. So thank you, Chris, for your time. Thanks for sharing all you did with us. It was a lot of fun. I don't know about you, but I am definitely watching Moulin Rouge and seeing if I can spot Chris in that one little dance scene. But anyways, moving forward, I want to share with you a little bit about what's to come. So next time Pivot Masters releases an episode, we're going to be hearing from someone who grew up in, let's say, I don't want to give away too much. This person grew up on a very small island. This person then moved to a large populous city in Canada, learned a specific skill. They were a dental hygienist, and then life happened, and now this person is in the U.S. I've had the pleasure of working with this person. They are one of my favorite coworkers, just lots of fun and really fascinating. Just what an incredible life story that this person has to share. I'm very excited and eager to share this story with you. It is our next episode. Remember, if you are a Patreon member, you get to hear that episode before everyone else. So please take a look at our Patreon page, patreon.com/pivotmasters. Otherwise, follow our Instagram. I am going to be posting pictures and bios of each of our guests as episodes are released. So you can see Chris's bio and his headshot if you want to put a face to the name. Of course, we'll share all of the information as far as how to reach him and that Kickstarter site and so on in the credits of this episode. Thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate it. This has been a ton of fun. Please come back, listen, share, subscribe, rate, tell your friends. We are excited to be on this journey, and thank you for joining us.